Disc 12.
Mr. Vincey's answer consisted chiefly in a demand that Lydgate should ensure his life, a demand immediately conceded. This was a delightfully reassuring idea, supposing that Lydgate died, but in the meantime, not a self-supporting idea. However, it seemed to make everything comfortable about Rosamond's marriage, and the necessary purchases went on with much spirit. Not without prudential considerations, however. A bride who is going to visit at a baronet's must have a few first-rate pocket handkerchiefs. But beyond the absolutely necessary half dozen, Rosamond contented herself without the very highest style of embroidery and Valenciennes. Lydgate also, finding that his sum of £800 had been considerably reduced since he had come to Middlemarch, restrained his inclination for some plate of an old pattern which was shown to him when he went into Kibble's establishment at Brassing to buy forks and spoons. He was too proud to act as if he presupposed that Mr. Vincey would advance money to provide furniture, and though, since it would not be necessary to pay for everything at once, some bills would be left standing over, he did not waste time in conjecturing how much his father-in-law would give in the form of dowry to make payment easy. He was not going to do anything extravagant, but the requisite things must be bought, and it would be bad economy to buy them of a poor quality. All these matters were by the by. Lydgate foresaw that science and his profession were the objects he should alone pursue enthusiastically, but he could not imagine himself pursuing them in such a home as Wrench had, the doors all open, the oilcloth worn, the children in soiled pinafores, and lunch lingering in the form of bones, black-handled knives, and willow pattern. But Wrench had a wretched lymphatic wife who made a mummy of herself indoors in a large shawl, and he must have altogether begun with an ill-chosen domestic apparatus. Rosamond, however, was on her side much occupied with conjectures, though her quick, imitative perception warned her against betraying them too crudely. "I shall like so much to know your family," she said one day when the wedding journey was being discussed. "We might perhaps take a direction that would allow us to see them as we return. Which of your uncles do you like best?"
"Oh, my Uncle Godwin, I think. He's a good-natured old fellow."
"You were constantly at his house at Qualingham when you were a boy, were you not? I should so like to see the old spot and everything you were used to. Does he know you are going to be married?"
"No," said Lydgate carelessly, turning in his chair and rubbing his hair up.
"Do send him word of it, you naughty, undutiful nephew. He will perhaps ask you to take me to Qualingham, and then you could show me about the grounds, and I could imagine you there when you were a boy. Remember, you see me in my home just as it has been since I was a child. It is not fair that I should be so ignorant of yours. But perhaps you would be a little ashamed of me. I forgot that." Lydgate smiled at her tenderly, and really accepted the suggestion that the proud pleasure of showing so charming a bride was worth some trouble. And now he came to think of it, he would like to see the old spots with Rosamond. "I will write to him, then. But my cousins are bores." It seemed magnificent to Rosamond to be able to speak so slightingly of a baronet's family, and she felt much contentment in the prospect of being able to estimate them contemptuously on her own account. But Mamma was near spoiling all a day or two later by saying, "I hope your uncle Sir Godwin will not look down on Rosie, Mr. Lydgate. I should think he would do something handsome. 1,000 or 2 can be nothing to a baronet." "Mamma," said Rosamond, blushing deeply. And Lydgate pitied her so much that he remained silent and went to the other end of the room to examine a print, curiously, as if he had been absent-minded. Mamma had a little filial lecture afterwards and was docile as usual. But Rosamond reflected that if any of those high-bred cousins who were bores should be induced to visit Middlemarch, they would see many things in her own family which might shock them. Hence it seemed desirable that Lydgate should, by and by, get some first-rate position elsewhere than in Middlemarch, and this could hardly be difficult in the case of a man who had a titled uncle and could make discoveries. Lydgate, you perceive, had talked fervidly to Rosamond of his hopes as to the highest uses of his life,
and had found it delightful to be listened to by a creature who would bring him the sweet furtherance of satisfying affection, beauty, repose, such help as our thoughts get from the summer sky and the flower-fringed meadows. Lydgate relied much on the psychological difference between what, for the sake of variety, I will call goose and gander, especially on the innate submissiveness of the goose as beautifully corresponding to the strength of the gander.
Chapter 37. The doubt hinted by Mr. Vincey whether it were only the general election or the end of the world that was coming on, now that George IV was dead, Parliament dissolved, Wellington and Peel generally depreciated and the new king apologetic, was a feeble type of the uncertainties in provincial opinion at that time. With the glow-worm lights of country places, how could men see which were their own thoughts in the confusion of a Tory ministry passing liberal measures, of Tory nobles and electors being anxious to return liberals rather than friends of the recreant ministers, and of outcries for remedies which seemed to have a mysteriously remote bearing on private interest and were made suspicious by the advocacy of disagreeable neighbours? Buyers of the Middlemarch newspapers found themselves in an anomalous position. During the agitation on the Catholic question, many had given up the Pioneer, which had a motto from Charles James Fox and was in the van of progress, because it had taken Peel's side about the Papists and had thus blotted its liberalism with a toleration of Jesuitry and Baal. But they were ill-satisfied with the Trumpet, which, since its blasts against Rome and in the general flaccidity of the public mind, nobody knowing who would support whom, had become feeble in its blowing. It was a time, according to a noticeable article in the Pioneer, when the crying needs of the country might well counteract a reluctance to public action on the part of men whose minds had from long experience acquired breadth as well as concentration, decision of judgment as well as tolerance, dispassionateness as well as energy. In fact, all those qualities which in the melancholy experience of mankind have been the least disposed to share lodgings. Mr. Hackbutt, whose fluent speech was at that time floating more widely than usual and leaving much uncertainty as to its ultimate channel, was heard to say in Mr. Hawley's office that the article in question emanated from Brooke of Tipton, and that Brooke had secretly bought the Pioneer some months ago. "That means mischief, eh?" said Mr. Hawley. "He's got the freak of being a popular man now, after dangling about like a stray tortoise. So much the worse for him. I've had my eye on him for some time. He shall be prettily pumped upon. He's a damned bad landlord. What business has an old county man to come currying favour with a low set of dark blue freemen? As to his paper, I only hope he may do the writing himself. It would be worth our paying for." "I understand he's got a very brilliant young fellow to edit it who can write the highest style of leading article, quite equal to anything in the London papers, and he means to take very high ground on reform." "Let Brooke reform his rent roll. He's a cursed old screw, and the buildings all over his estate are going to rack. I suppose this young fellow is some loose fish from London." "His name is Ladislaw. He is said to be of foreign extraction." "I know the sort," said Mr. Hawley. "Some emissary. He'll begin with a flourish about the rights of man and end with murdering a wench. That's the style." "You must concede that there are abuses, Hawley," said Mr. Hackbutt, foreseeing some political disagreement with his family lawyer. "I myself should never favour immoderate views. In fact, I take my stand with Huskisson. But I cannot blind myself to the consideration that the non-representation of large towns—" "Large towns be damned," said Mr. Hawley, impatient of exposition. "I know a little too much about Middlemarch elections. Let 'em quash every pocket borough tomorrow and bring in every mushroom town in the kingdom. They'll only increase the expense of getting into Parliament. I go upon facts." Mr. Hawley's disgust at the notion of the Pioneer being edited by an emissary, and of Brooke becoming actively political, as if a tortoise of desultory pursuits should protrude its small head ambitiously and become rampant, was hardly equal to the annoyance felt by some members of Mr. Brooke's own family. The result had oozed forth gradually, like the discovery that your neighbour has set up an unpleasant kind of manufacture which will be permanently under your nostrils without legal remedy. The Pioneer had been secretly bought even before Will Ladislaw's arrival. the expected opportunity having offered itself in the readiness of the proprietor to part with valuable property which did not pay. And in the interval since Mr. Brooke had written his invitation, those germinal ideas of making his mind tell upon the world at large, which had been present in him from his younger years, but had hitherto lain in some obstruction, had been sprouting under cover. The development was much furthered by a delight in his guest, which proved greater even than he had anticipated. For it seemed Will was not only at home in all those artistic and literary subjects which Mr. Brooke had gone into at one time, but that he was strikingly ready at seizing the points of the political situation and dealing with them in that large spirit which, aided by adequate memory, lends itself to quotation and general effectiveness of treatment. "He seems to me a kind of Shelley, you know," Mr. Brooke took an opportunity of saying, for the gratification of Mr. Casaubon. "I don't mean as to anything objectionable, laxities or atheism or anything of that kind, you know. Ladislaw's sentiments in every way, I am sure, are good. Indeed, we were talking a great deal together last night. But he has the same sort of enthusiasm for liberty, freedom, emancipation. A fine thing under guidance. Under guidance, you know. I think I shall be able to put him on the right tack. And I am the more pleased because he is a relation of yours, Casaubon." If the right tack implied anything more precise than the rest of Mr. Brooke's speech, Mr. Casaubon silently hoped that it referred to some occupation at a great distance from Lowick. He had disliked Will while he helped him, but he had begun to dislike him still more now that Will had declined his help. That is the way with us when we have an uneasy jealousy in our disposition. If our talents are chiefly of the burrowing kind, our honey-sipping cousin, whom we have grave reasons for objecting to, is likely to have a secret contempt for us, and anyone who admires him passes an oblique criticism on ourselves. Having the scruples of rectitude in our souls, we are above the meanness of injuring him. Rather, we meet all his claims on us by active benefits, and the drawing of checks for him, being a superiority which he must recognize, gives our bitterness a milder infusion. Now, Mr. Casaubon had been deprived of that superiority, as anything more than a remembrance, in a sudden, capricious manner. His antipathy to Will did not spring from the common jealousy of a winter-worn husband. It was something deeper, bred by his lifelong claims and discontents. But Dorothea, now that she was present, Dorothea as a young wife, who herself had shown an offensive capability of criticism, necessarily gave concentration to the uneasiness which had before been vague. Will Ladislaw, on his side, felt that his dislike was flourishing at the expense of his gratitude, and spent much inward discourse in justifying the dislike. Casaubon hated him. He knew that very well. On his first entrance he could discern a bitterness in the mouth and a venom in the glance, which would almost justify declaring war in spite of past benefits. He was much obliged to Casaubon in the past, but really the act of marrying this wife was a set-off against the obligation. It was a question whether gratitude, which refers to what is done for oneself, ought not to give way to indignation at what is done against another. And Casaubon had done a wrong to Dorothea in marrying her. A man was bound to know himself better than that, and if he chose to grow grey, crunching bones in a cavern, he had no business to be luring a girl into his companionship. "It is the most horrible of virgin sacrifices," said Will. And he painted to himself what were Dorothea's inward sorrows, as if he had been writing a choric wail. But he would never lose sight of her. He would watch over her. If he gave up everything else in life, he would watch over her. And she should know that she had one slave in the world. Will had, to use Sir Thomas Browne's phrase, a passionate prodigality of statement, both to himself and others. The simple truth was that nothing then invited him so strongly as the presence of Dorothea. Invitations of the formal kind had been wanting, however, for Will had never been asked to go to Lowick. Mr. Brooke, indeed, confident of doing everything agreeable which Casaubon, poor fellow, was too much absorbed to think of, had arranged to bring Ladislaw de Lowick several times, not neglecting meanwhile to introduce him elsewhere on every opportunity as a young relative of Casaubon's. And though Will had not seen Dorothea alone, their interviews had been enough to restore her former sense of young companionship with one who was cleverer than herself, yet seemed ready to be swayed by her. Poor Dorothea, before her marriage, had never found much room in other minds for what she cared most to say, and she had not, as we know, enjoyed her husband's superior instruction so much as she had expected. If she spoke with any keenness of interest to Mr. Casaubon, he heard her with an air of patience, as if she had given a quotation from the Delectus, familiar to him from his tender years, and sometimes mentioned curtly what ancient sects or personages had held similar ideas, as if there were too much of that sort in stock already. At other times, he would inform her that she was mistaken, and reassert what her remark had questioned. But Will Ladislaw always seemed to see more in what she said than she herself saw. Dorothea had little vanity, but she had the ardent woman's need to rule beneficently by making the joy of another soul. Hence, the mere chance of seeing Will occasionally was like a lunette opened in the wall of her prison, giving her a glimpse of the sunny air. And this pleasure began to nullify her original alarm at what her husband might think about the introduction of Will as her uncle's guest. On this subject, Mr. Casaubon had remained dumb. But Will wanted to talk with Dorothea alone, and was impatient of slow circumstances. However slight the terrestrial intercourse between Dante and Beatrice or Petrarch and Laura, time changes the proportion of things, and in later days it is preferable to have fewer sonnets and more conversation. Necessity excused stratagem, but stratagem was limited by the dread of offending Dorothea. He found out at last that he wanted to take a particular sketch at Lowick, and one morning when Mr. Brooke had to drive along the Lowick road on his way to the county town, Will asked to be set down with his sketchbook and campstool at Lowick, and without announcing himself at the manor, settled himself to sketch, in a position where he must see Dorothea if she came out to walk, and he knew that she usually walked an hour in the morning. But the stratagem was defeated by the weather. Clouds gathered with treacherous quickness, the rain came down, and Will was obliged to take shelter in the house. He intended, on the strength of relationship, to go into the drawing-room and wait there without being announced, and seeing his old acquaintance, the butler, in the hall, he said, "Don't mention that I am here, Pratt. I will wait till luncheon. I know Mr. Casaubon does not like to be disturbed when he is in the library." "Master is out, sir. There's only Mrs. Casaubon in the library." "I'd better tell her you're here, sir," said Pratt, a red-cheeked man given to lively converse with Tantrip, and often agreeing with her that it must be dull for Madam. "Oh, very well. This confounded rain has hindered me from sketching," said Will, feeling so happy that he affected indifference with delightful ease. In another minute he was in the library, and Dorothea was meeting him with her sweet, unconstrained smile. "Mr. Casaubon has gone to the Archdeacon's," she said at once. "I don't know whether he will be at home again long before dinner. He was uncertain how long he should be. Did you want to say anything particular to him?" "No. I came to sketch, but the rain drove me in. Else I would not have disturbed you yet. I supposed that Mr. Casaubon was here, and I know he dislikes interruption at this hour." "I am indebted to the rain, then. I am so glad to see you." Dorothea uttered these common words with the simple sincerity of an unhappy child visited at school. "I really came for the chance of seeing you alone," said Will, mysteriously forced to be just as simple as she was. He could not stay to ask himself, why not? "I wanted to talk about things as we did in Rome. It always makes a difference when other people are present." "Yes," said Dorothea, in her clear, full tone of assent. "Sit down." She seated herself on a dark ottoman, with the brown books behind her, looking, in her plain dress of some thin, woolen-white material, without a single ornament on her besides her wedding ring, as if she were under a vow to be different from all other women. And Will sat down opposite her at 2 yards' distance, the light falling on his bright curls and delicate but rather petulant profile, with its defiant curves of lip and chin. Each looked at the other as if they had been two flowers which had opened then and there. Dorothea for the moment forgot her husband's mysterious irritation against Will. It seemed fresh water at her thirsty lips to speak without fear to the one person whom she had found receptive. For in looking backward through sadness, she exaggerated a past solace. "I have often thought that I should like to talk to you again," she said immediately. "It seems strange to me how many things I said to you."
"I remember them all," said Will,
with the unspeakable content in his soul of feeling that he was in the presence of a creature worthy to be perfectly loved. I think his own feelings at that moment were perfect, for we mortals have our divine moments when love is satisfied in the completeness of the beloved object. "I have tried to learn a great deal since we were in Rome," said Dorothea. "I can read Latin a little, and I am beginning to understand just a little Greek. I can help Mr. Casaubon better now. I can find out references for him and save his eyes in many ways. But it is very difficult to be learned. It seems as if people were worn out on the way to great thoughts and can never enjoy them because they are too tired."
"If a man has a capacity for great thoughts, he is likely to overtake them before he is decrepit," said Will, with irrepressible quickness.
But through certain sensibilities, Dorothea was as quick as he. And seeing her face change, he added immediately,
"But it is quite true that the best minds have been sometimes overstrained in working out their ideas."
"You correct me," said Dorothea. "I expressed myself ill. I should have said that those who have great thoughts get too much worn in working them out. I used to feel about that even when I was a little girl, and it always seemed to me that the use I should like to make of my life would be to help someone who did great works, so that his burthen might be lighter."
Dorothea was led on to this bit of autobiography without any sense of making a revelation, but she had never before said anything to Will which threw so strong a light on her marriage. He did not shrug his shoulders, and for want of that muscular outlet, he thought the more irritably of beautiful lips kissing holy skulls, and other emptinesses ecclesiastically enshrined. Also, he had to take care that his speech should not betray that thought. "But you may easily carry the help too far," he said, "and get overwrought yourself. You are not too much shut up. You already look paler. It would be better for Mr. Casaubon to have a secretary. He could easily get a man who would do half his work for him. It would save him more effectually, and you need only help him in lighter ways."
"How can you think of that?" said Dorothea, in a tone of earnest remonstrance. "I should have no happiness if I did not help him in his work. What could I do? There is no good to be done in Lowick. The only thing I desire is to help him more. And he objects to a secretary. Please not to mention that again."
"Certainly not, now I know your feeling. But I have heard both Mr. Brooke and Sir James Chetham express the same wish."
"Yes," said Dorothea, "but they don't understand. They want me to be a great deal on horseback and have the garden altered and new conservatories to fill up my days. I thought you could understand that one's mind has other wants," she added, rather impatiently. "Besides, Mr. Casaubon cannot bear to hear of a secretary."
"My mistake is excusable," said Will. "In old days I used to hear Mr. Casaubon speak as if he looked forward to having a secretary. Indeed, he held out the prospect of that office to me. But I turned out to be not good enough for it."
Dorothea was trying to extract out of this an excuse for her husband's evident repulsion, as she said with a playful smile,
"You were not a steady worker enough."
"No," said Will, shaking his head backward, somewhat after the manner of a spirited horse.
And then, the old irritable demon prompting him to give another good pinch at the moth wings of poor Mr. Casaubon's glory, he went on,
"And I have seen since that Mr. Casaubon does not like anyone to overlook his work and know thoroughly what he is doing. He is too doubtful, too uncertain of himself. I may not be good for much, but he dislikes me because I disagree with him." Will was not without his intentions to be always generous. But our tongues are little triggers which have usually been pulled before general intentions can be brought to bear. And it was too intolerable that Casaubon's dislike of him should not be fairly accounted for to Dorothea. Yet when he had spoken, he was rather uneasy as to the effect on her. But Dorothea was strangely quiet, not immediately indignant, as she had been on a like occasion in Rome. And the cause lay deep. She was no longer struggling against the perception of facts, but adjusting herself to their clearest perception. And now, when she looked steadily at her husband's failure, still more at his possible consciousness of failure, she seemed to be looking along the one track where duty became tenderness. Will's want of reticence might have been met with more severity if he had not already been recommended to her mercy by her husband's dislike, which must seem hard to her till she saw better reason for it. She did not answer at once, but after looking down ruminatingly, she said, with some earnestness, "Mr. Casaubon must have overcome his dislike of you, so far as his actions were concerned, and that is admirable."
"Yes, he has shown a sense of justice in family matters. It was an abominable thing that my grandmother should have been disinherited because she made what they called a mésalliance, though there was nothing to be said against her husband except that he was a Polish refugee who gave lessons for his bread."
"I wish I knew all about her," said Dorothea. "I wonder how she bore the change from wealth to poverty. I wonder whether she was happy with her husband. Do you know much about them?"
"No, only that my grandfather was a patriot. A bright fellow, could speak many languages. Musical. Got his bread by teaching all sorts of things. They both died rather early. And I never knew much of my father beyond what my mother told me. But he inherited the musical talents. I remember his slow walk and his long, thin hands. And one day remains with me when he was lying ill, and I was very hungry and had only a little bit of bread."
"Ah, what a different life from mine," said Dorothea, with keen interest, clasping her hands on her lap. "I have always had too much of everything. But tell me how it was. Mr. Casaubon could not have known about you then."
"No, but my father had made himself known to Mr. Casaubon, and that was my last hungry day. My father died soon after, and my mother and I were well taken care of. Mr. Casaubon always expressly recognized it as his duty to take care of us, because of the harsh injustice which had been shown to his mother's sister. But now I am telling you what is not new to you."
In his inmost soul, Will was conscious of wishing to tell Dorothea what was rather new, even in his own construction of things, namely, that Mr. Casaubon had never done more than pay a debt towards him. Will was much too good a fellow to be easy under the sense of being ungrateful, and when gratitude has become a matter of reasoning, there are many ways of escaping from its bonds.
"No," answered Dorothea, "Mr. Casaubon has always avoided dwelling on his honourable actions."
She did not feel that her husband's conduct was depreciated, but this notion of what justice had required in his relations with Will Ladislaw took strong hold on her mind. After a moment's pause, she added, "He had never told me that he supported your mother. Is she still living?"
"No. She died by an accident, a fall, 4 years ago. It is curious that my mother too ran away from her family, but not for the sake of her husband. She never would tell me anything about her family, except that she forsook them to get her own living. Went on the stage, in fact. She was a dark-eyed creature with crisp ringlets and never seemed to be getting old. You see, I come from rebellious blood on both sides," Will ended, smiling brightly at Dorothea, while she was still looking with serious intentness before her, like a child seeing a drama for the first time. But her face too broke into a smile, as she said, "That is your apology, I suppose, for having yourself been rather rebellious. I mean, to Mr. Casaubon's wishes. You must remember that you have not done what he thought best for you. And if he dislikes you—you were speaking of dislike a little while ago, but I should rather say
if he has shown any painful feelings towards you. You must consider how sensitive he has become from the wearing effect of study. Perhaps, she continued, getting into a pleading tone, my uncle has not told you how serious Mr. Casaubon's illness was. It would be petty of us who are well and can bear things to think much of small offences from those who carry a weight of trial.
You teach me better, said Will. I will never grumble on that subject again.
There was a gentleness in his tone, which came from the unutterable contentment of perceiving, what Dorothea was hardly conscious of, that she was travelling into the remoteness of pure pity and loyalty towards her husband. Will was ready to adore her pity and loyalty, if she would associate himself with her in manifesting them.
I have really sometimes been a perverse fellow, he went on, but I will never again, if I can help it, do or say what you would disapprove.
That is very good of you, said Dorothea, with another open smile. I shall have a little kingdom then, where I shall give laws. But you will soon go away, out of my rule, I imagine. You will soon be tired of staying at the Grange.
That is a point I wanted to mention to you, one of the reasons why I wish to speak to you alone. Mr. Brooke proposes that I should stay in this neighbourhood. He has bought one of the Middlemarch newspapers, and he wishes me to conduct that, and also to help him in other ways.
Would not that be a sacrifice of higher prospects for you? Said Dorothea.
Perhaps, but I have always been blamed for thinking of prospects and not settling to anything. And here is something offered to me. If you would not like me to accept it, I will give it up. Otherwise, I would rather stay in this part of the country than go away. I belong to nobody anywhere else.
I should like you to stay very much, said Dorothea at once, as simply and readily as she had spoken at Rome. There was not the shadow of a reason in her mind at the moment why she should not say so.
Then I will stay, said Ladislaw, shaking his head backward, rising and going towards the window as if to see whether the rain had ceased. But the next moment, Dorothea, according to a habit which was getting continually stronger, began to reflect that her husband felt differently from herself, and she coloured deeply, under the double embarrassment of having expressed what might be in opposition to her husband's feeling, and of having to suggest this opposition to Will. His face was not turned towards her, and this made it easier to say, "But my opinion is of little consequence on such a subject. I think you should be guided by Mr. Casaubon. I spoke without thinking of anything else than my own feeling, which has nothing to do with the real question. But it now occurs to me, perhaps Mr. Casaubon might see that the proposal was not wise. Can you not wait now and mention it to him?"
"I can't wait today," said Will, inwardly scared by the possibility that Mr. Casaubon would enter. "The rain is quite over now. I told Mr. Brooke not to call for me. I would rather walk the 5 miles. I shall strike across Holsall Common and see the gleams on the wet grass. I like that."
He approached her to shake hands quite hurriedly, longing but not daring to say, "Don't mention the subject to Mr. Casaubon." No, he dared not, could not say it. To ask her to be less simple and direct would be like breathing on the crystal that you want to see the light through. And there was always the other great dread, of himself becoming dimmed and forever ray-shorn in her eyes.
"I wish you could have stayed," said Dorothea, with a touch of mournfulness as she rose and put out her hand.
She also had her thought which she did not like to express. Will certainly ought to lose no time in consulting Mr. Casaubon's wishes, but for her to urge this might seem an undue dictation. So they only said goodbye, and Will quitted the house, striking across the fields so as not to run any risk of encountering Mr. Casaubon's carriage, which, however, did not appear at the gate until 4 o'clock. That was an unpropitious hour for coming home. It was too early to gain the moral support under ennui of dressing his person for dinner, and too late to undress his mind of the day's frivolous ceremony and affairs, so as to be prepared for a good plunge into the serious business of study. On such occasions He usually threw himself into an easy chair in the library and allowed Dorothea to read the London papers to him, closing his eyes the while. Today, however, he declined that relief, observing that he had already had too many public details urged upon him. But he spoke more cheerfully than usual when Dorothea asked about his fatigue, and added, with that air of formal effort which never forsook him, even when he spoke without his waistcoat and cravat, "I have had the gratification of meeting my former acquaintance, Dr. Spanning, today, and of being praised by one who is himself a worthy recipient of praise. He spoke very handsomely of my late tractate on the Egyptian mysteries, using, in fact, terms which it would not become me to repeat." In uttering the last clause, Mr. Casaubon leaned over the elbow of his chair and swayed his head up and down, apparently as a muscular outlet instead of that recapitulation which would not have been becoming. "I am very glad you have had that pleasure," said Dorothea, delighted to see her husband less weary than usual at this hour. "Before you came, I had been regretting that you happened to be out today."
"Why so, my dear?" said Mr. Casaubon, throwing himself backward again.
"Because Mr. Ladislaw has been here, and he has mentioned a proposal of my uncle's which I should like to know your opinion of." Her husband, she felt, was really concerned in this question. Even with her ignorance of the world, she had a vague impression that the position offered to Will was out of keeping with his family connections. And certainly Mr. Casaubon had a claim to be consulted. He did not speak, but merely bowed. "Dear uncle, you know, has many projects. It appears that he has bought one of the Middlemarch newspapers, and he has asked Mr. Ladislaw to stay in this neighbourhood and conduct the paper for him, besides helping him in other ways." Dorothea looked at her husband while she spoke, but he had at first blinked, and finally closed his eyes, as if to save them, while his lips became more tense. "What is your opinion?" she added rather timidly, after a slight pause.
"Did Mr. Ladislaw come on purpose to ask my opinion?" said Mr. Casaubon, opening his eyes narrowly with a knife-edge look at Dorothea.
She was really uncomfortable on the point he inquired about, but she only became a little more serious, and her eyes did not swerve. "No," she answered immediately, "he did not say that he came to ask your opinion. But when he mentioned the proposal, he, of course, expected me to tell you of it." Mr. Casaubon was silent. "I feared that you might feel some objection. But certainly a young man with so much talent might be very useful to my uncle, might help him to do good in a better way. And Mr. Ladislaw wishes to have some fixed occupation. He has been blamed, he says, for not seeking something of that kind. And he would like to stay in this neighbourhood, because no one cares for him elsewhere." Dorothea felt that this was a consideration to soften her husband. However, he did not speak, and she presently recurred to Dr. Spanning and the Archdeacon's breakfast. But there was no longer sunshine on these subjects. The next morning, without Dorothea's knowledge, Mr. Casaubon dispatched the following letter, beginning, "Dear Mr. Ladislaw." He had always before addressed him as Will. "Mrs. Casaubon informs me that a proposal has been made to you, and, according to an inference by no means stretched, has on your part been in some degree entertained, which involves your residence in this neighbourhood in a capacity which I am justified in saying touches my own position in such a way as renders it not only natural and warrantable in me, when that effect is viewed under the influence of legitimate feeling, but incumbent on me, when the same effect is considered in the light of my responsibilities, to state at once that your acceptance of the proposal above indicated would be highly offensive to me. That I have some claim to the exercise of a veto here would not, I believe, be denied by any reasonable person cognizant of the relations between us. Relations which, though thrown into the past by your recent procedure, are not thereby annulled in their character of determining antecedents.
I will not here make reflections on any person's judgment. It is enough for me to point out to yourself that there are certain social fitnesses and proprieties which should hinder a somewhat near relative of mine from becoming in any wise conspicuous in this vicinity in a status not only much beneath my own, but associated at best with the sciolism of literary or political adventurers. At any rate, the contrary issue must exclude you from further reception at my house. Yours faithfully, Edward Casaubon.
Meanwhile, Dorothea's mind was innocently at work towards the further embitterment of her husband. Dwelling with a sympathy that grew to agitation, on what Will had told her about his parents and grandparents. Any private hours in her day were usually spent in her blue-green boudoir, and she had come to be very fond of its pallid quaintness. Nothing had been outwardly altered there, but while the summer had gradually advanced over the western fields beyond the avenue of elms, the bare room had gathered within it those memories of an inward life which fill the air as with a cloud of good or bad angels, the invisible yet active forms of our spiritual triumphs or our spiritual falls. She had been so used to struggle for and to find resolve in looking along the avenue towards the arch of western light, that the vision itself had gained a communicating power. Even the pale stag seemed to have reminding glances and to mean mutely, "Yes, we know." And the group of delicately touched miniatures had made an audience, as of beings no longer disturbed about their own earthly lot, but still humanly interested. Especially the mysterious Aunt Julia, about whom Dorothea had never found it easy to question her husband. And now, since her conversation with Will, many fresh images had gathered round that Aunt Julia who was Will's grandmother. The presence of that delicate miniature, so like a living face that she knew, helping to concentrate her feelings. What a wrong to cut off the girl from the family protection and inheritance only because she had chosen a man who was poor. Dorothea, early troubling her elders with questions about the facts around her, had wrought herself into some independent clearness as to the historical political reasons why eldest sons had superior rights and why land should be entailed. Those reasons, impressing her with a certain awe, might be weightier than she knew. But here was a question of ties which left them uninfringed. Here was a daughter whose child, even according to the ordinary aping of aristocratic institutions by people who are no more aristocratic than retired grocers and who have no more land to keep together than a lawn and a paddock, would have a prior claim. Was inheritance a question of liking or of responsibility? All the energy of Dorothea's nature went on the side of responsibility, the fulfilment of claims founded on our own deeds, such as marriage and parentage. It was true, she said to herself, that Mr. Casaubon had a debt to the Ladislaws, that he had to pay back what the Ladislaws had been wronged of. And now she began to think of her husband's will, which had been made at the time of their marriage, leaving the bulk of his property to her, with proviso in case of her having children. That ought to be altered, and no time ought to be lost. This very question which had just arisen about Will Ladislaw's occupation was the occasion for placing things on a new, right footing. Her husband, she felt sure, according to all his previous conduct, would be ready to take the just view if she proposed it. She, in whose interest an unfair concentration of the property had been urged. His sense of right had surmounted and would continue to surmount anything that might be called antipathy. She suspected that her uncle's scheme was disapproved by Mr. Casaubon, and this made it seem all the more opportune that a fresh understanding should be begun, so that instead of Will's starting penniless and accepting the first function that offered itself, he should find himself in possession of a rightful income which should be paid by her husband during his life, and by an immediate alteration of the will should be secured at his death. The vision of all this as what ought to be done seemed to Dorothea like a sudden letting in of daylight, waking her from her previous stupidity and incurious, self-absorbed ignorance about her husband's relation to others.
Will Ladislaw had refused Mr. Casaubon's future aid on a ground that no longer appeared right to her. And Mr. Casaubon had never himself seen fully what was the claim upon him.
"But he will," said Dorothea. "The great strength of his character lies here. And what are we doing with our money? We make no use of half of our income. My own money buys me nothing but an uneasy conscience."
There was a peculiar fascination for Dorothea in this division of property intended for herself and always regarded by her as excessive. She was blind, you see, to many things obvious to others, likely to tread in the wrong places, as Celia had warned her. Yet her blindness to whatever did not lie in her own pure purpose carried her safely by the side of precipices where vision would have been perilous with fear. The thoughts which had gathered vividness in the solitude of her boudoir occupied her incessantly through the day on which Mr. Casaubon had sent his letter to Will. Everything seemed hindrance to her till she could find an opportunity of opening her heart to her husband. To his preoccupied mind, all subjects were to be approached gently, and she had never, since his illness, lost from her consciousness the dread of agitating him. But when young ardour is set brooding over the conception of a prompt deed, the deed itself seems to start forth with independent life, mastering ideal obstacles. The day passed in a sombre fashion, not unusual, though Mr. Casaubon was perhaps unusually silent. But there were hours of the night which might be counted on as opportunities of conversation. For Dorothea, when aware of her husband's sleeplessness, had established the habit of rising, lighting a candle, and reading him to sleep again. And this night she was from the beginning sleepless, excited by resolves. He slept as usual for a few hours, but she had risen softly and had sat in the darkness for nearly an hour before he said,
"Dorothea, since you are up, will you light a candle?"
"Do you feel ill, dear?" was her first question as she obeyed him.
"No, not at all. But I shall be obliged, since you are up, if you will read me a few pages of Louth."
"May I talk to you a little instead?" said Dorothea.
"Certainly."
"I have been thinking about money all day. That I have always had too much, and especially the prospect of too much."
"These, my dear Dorothea, are providential arrangements."
"But if one has too much in consequence of others being wronged, it seems to me that the divine voice which tells us to set that wrong right must be obeyed."
"What, my love, is the bearing of your remark?"
"That you have been too liberal in arrangements for me. I mean, with regard to property. And that makes me unhappy."
"How so? I have none but comparatively distant connections."
"I have been led to think about your Aunt Julia, and how she was left in poverty only because she married a poor man, an act which was not disgraceful, since he was not unworthy. It was on that ground, I know, that you educated Mr. Ladislaw and provided for his mother." Dorothea waited a few moments for some answer that would help her onward. None came, and her next words seemed the more forcible to her, falling clear upon the dark silence. "But surely we should regard his claim as a much greater one, even to the half of that property which I know that you have destined for me. And I think he ought at once to be provided for, on that understanding. It is not right that he should be in the dependence of poverty while we are rich. And if there is any objection to the proposal he mentioned, the giving him his true place and his true share would set aside any motive for his accepting it."
"Mr. Ladislaw has probably been speaking to you on this subject," said Mr. Casaubon, with a certain biting quickness not habitual to him.
"Indeed, no," said Dorothea earnestly. "How can you imagine it, since he has so lately declined everything from you? I fear you think too hardly of him, dear.
He only told me a little about his parents and grandparents, and almost all in answer to my questions. You are so good, so just. You have done everything you thought to be right. But it seems to me clear that more than that is right. And I must speak about it, since I am the person who would get what is called benefit by that more not being done. There was a perceptible pause before Mr. Casaubon replied, not quickly as before, but with a still more biting emphasis. Dorothea, my love, this is not the first occasion, but it were well that it should be the last, on which you have assumed a judgment on subjects beyond your scope. Into the question how far conduct, especially in the matter of alliances, constitutes a forfeiture of family claims, I do not now enter. Suffice it that you are not here qualified to discriminate. What I now wish you to understand is that I accept no revision, still less dictation, within that range of affairs which I have deliberated upon as distinctly and properly mine. It is not for you to interfere between me and Mr. Ladislaw, and still less to encourage communications from him to you which constitute a criticism on my procedure. Poor Dorothea, shrouded in the darkness, was in a tumult of conflicting emotions. Alarm at the possible effect on himself of her husband's strongly manifested anger would have checked any expression of her own resentment, even if she had been quite free from doubt and compunction under the consciousness that there might be some justice in his last insinuation. Hearing him breathe quickly after he had spoken, she sat listening, frightened, wretched, with a dumb inward cry for help to bear this nightmare of a life, in which every energy was arrested by dread. But nothing else happened, except that they both remained a long while sleepless, without speaking again. The next day, Mr. Casaubon received the following answer from Will Ladislaw. Dear Mr. Casaubon, I have given all due consideration to your letter of yesterday, but I am unable to take precisely your view of our mutual position. With the fullest acknowledgement of your generous conduct to me in the past, I must still maintain that an obligation of this kind cannot fairly fetter me, as you appear to expect that it should. Granted that a benefactor's wishes may constitute a claim, there must always be a reservation as to the quality of those wishes. They may possibly clash with more imperative considerations. Or a benefactor's veto might impose such a negation on a man's life that the consequent blank might be more cruel than the benefaction was generous. I am merely using strong illustrations. In the present case, I am unable to take your view of the bearing which my acceptance of occupation, not enriching certainly, but not dishonourable, will have on your own position, which seems to me too substantial to be affected in that shadowy manner. And though I do not believe that any change in our relations will occur, certainly none has yet occurred, which can nullify the obligations imposed on me by the past, pardon me for not seeing that those obligations should restrain me from using the ordinary freedom of living where I choose, and maintaining myself by any lawful occupation I may choose. Regretting that there exists this difference between us, as to a relation in which the conferring of benefits has been entirely on your side, I remain yours with persistent obligation, Will Ladislaw. Poor Mr. Casaubon felt, and must not we, being impartial, feel with him a little, that no man had juster cause for disgust and suspicion than he. Young Ladislaw, he was sure, meant to defy and annoy him, meant to win Dorothea's confidence and sow her mind with disrespect and perhaps aversion towards her husband. Some motive beneath the surface had been needed to account for Will's sudden change of course in rejecting Mr. Casaubon's aid and quitting his travels. And this defiant determination to fix himself in the neighbourhood
by taking up something so much at variance with his former choice as Mr. Brooke's Middlemarch projects, revealed clearly enough that the undeclared motive had relation to Dorothea. Not for one moment did Mr. Casaubon suspect Dorothea of any doubleness. He had no suspicions of her. But he had what was little less uncomfortable, the positive knowledge that her tendency to form opinions about her husband's conduct was accompanied with a disposition to regard Will Ladislaw favourably and be influenced by what he said. His own proud reticence had prevented him from ever being undeceived in the supposition that Dorothea had originally asked her uncle to invite Will to his house. And now, on receiving Will's letter, Mr. Casaubon had to consider his duty. It would never have been easy to call his action anything else than duty. But in this case, contending motives thrust him back into negations. Should he apply directly to Mr. Brooke and demand of that troublesome gentleman to revoke his proposal? Or should he consult Sir James Chettam and get him to concur in remonstrance against a step which touched the whole family? In either case, Mr. Casaubon was aware that failure was just as probable as success. It was impossible for him to mention Dorothea's name in the matter, and without some alarming urgency, Mr. Brooke was as likely as not, after meeting all representations with apparent assent, to wind up by saying, "Never fear, Casaubon. Depend upon it. Young Ladislaw will do you credit. Depend upon it. I have put my finger on the right thing." And Mr. Casaubon shrank nervously from communicating on the subject with Sir James Chettam, between whom and himself there had never been cordiality, and who would immediately think of Dorothea without any mention of her. Poor Mr. Casaubon was distrustful of everybody's feeling towards him, especially as a husband. To let anyone suppose that he was jealous would be to admit their suspected view of his disadvantages. To let them know that he did not find marriage particularly blissful would imply his conversion to their, probably, earlier disapproval. It would be as bad as letting Carp, and Brazenose generally, know how backward he was in organizing the matter for his key to all mythologies. All through his life, Mr. Casaubon had been trying not to admit even to himself the inward sores of self-doubt and jealousy. And on the most delicate of all personal subjects, the habit of proud, suspicious reticence told doubly. Thus Mr. Casaubon remained proudly, bitterly silent. But he had forbidden Will to come to Lowick Manor, and he was mentally preparing other means of frustration. Chapter 38. Sir James Chettam could not look with any satisfaction on Mr. Brooke's new courses, but it was easier to object than to hinder. Sir James accounted for his having come in alone one day to lunch with the Cadwalladers by saying, "I can't talk to you as I want before Celia. It might hurt her. Indeed, it would not be right." "I know what you mean. The pioneer at the Grange," darted in Mrs. Cadwallader almost before the word was off her friend's tongue. "It is frightful, this taking to buying whistles and blowing them in everybody's hearing. Lying in bed all day and playing at dominoes like poor Lord Plessy would be more private and bearable." "I see they are beginning to attack our friend Brooke in the trumpet," said the rector, lounging back and smiling easily, as he would have done if he had been attacked himself. "There are tremendous sarcasms against a landlord not 100 miles from Middlemarch, who receives his own rents and makes no returns." "I do wish Brooke would leave that off," said Sir James, with his little frown of annoyance. "Is he really going to be put in nomination, though?" said Mr. Cadwallader. "I saw Fairbrother yesterday. He's Whiggish himself, hoists broom and useful knowledge. That's the worst I know of him. And he says that Brooke is getting up a pretty strong party. Bulstrode the banker is his foremost man. But he thinks Brooke would come off badly at a nomination." "Exactly," said Sir James with earnestness. "I have been inquiring into the thing, for I've never known anything about Middlemarch politics before, the county being my business. What Brooke trusts to is that they are going to turn out Oliver because he is a Peelite.
But Hawley tells me that if they send up a Whig at all, it is sure to be Bagster, one of those candidates who come from heaven knows where, but dead against ministers and an experienced parliamentary man. Hawley is rather rough. He forgot that he was speaking to me. He said if Brooke wanted a pelting, he could get it cheaper than by going to the hustings.
"I warned you all of it," said Mrs. Cadwallader, waving her hands outward. "I said to Humphrey long ago, Mr. Brooke is going to make a splash in the mud, and now he has done it."
"Well, he might have taken it into his head to marry," said the rector. "That would have been a graver mess than a little flirtation with politics."
"He may do that afterwards," said Mrs. Cadwallader, "when he has come out on the other side of the mud with an ague."
"What I care for most is his own dignity," said Sir James. "Of course I care the more because of the family. But he's getting on in life now, and I don't like to think of his exposing himself. They will be raking up everything against him."
"I suppose it's no use trying any persuasion," said the rector.
"There's such an odd mixture of obstinacy and changeableness in Brooke. Have you tried him on the subject?"
"Well, no," said Sir James. "I feel a delicacy in appearing to dictate. But I have been talking to this young Ladislaw that Brooke is making a factotum of. Ladislaw seems clever enough for anything. I thought it as well to hear what he had to say. And he is against Brooke's standing this time. I think he'll turn him round. I think the nomination may be staved off."
"I know," said Mrs. Cadwallader, nodding. "The independent member hasn't got his speeches well enough by heart."
"But this Ladislaw, there again is a vexatious business," said Sir James. "We have had him two or three times to dine at the Hall. You have met him, by the by, as Brooke's guest and a relation of Casaubon's, thinking he was only on a flying visit. And now I find he's in everybody's mouth in Middlemarch as the editor of the Pioneer. There are stories going about him as a quill-driving alien, a foreign emissary and what not."
"Casaubon won't like that," said the rector.
"There is some foreign blood in Ladislaw," returned Sir James. "I hope he won't go into extreme opinions and carry Brooke on."
"Oh, he's a dangerous young sprig, that Mr. Ladislaw," said Mrs. Cadwallader, "with his opera songs and his ready tongue. A sort of Byronic hero, an amorous conspirator, it strikes me. And Thomas Aquinas is not fond of him. I could see that the day the picture was brought."
"I don't like to begin on the subject with Casaubon," said Sir James. "He has more right to interfere than I. But it's a disagreeable affair all round. What a character for anybody with decent connections to show himself in. One of those newspaper fellows. You have only to look at Keck, who manages the Trumpet. I saw him the other day with Hawley. His writing is sound enough, I believe, but he's such a low fellow that I wished he had been on the wrong side."
"What can you expect with these peddling Middlemarch papers?" said the rector. "I don't suppose you could get a high style of man anywhere to be writing up interests he doesn't really care about, and for pay that hardly keeps him in at elbows."
"Exactly. That makes it so annoying that Brooke should have put a man who has a sort of connection with the family in a position of that kind. For my part, I think Ladislaw is rather a fool for accepting."
"It is Aquinas's fault," said Mrs. Cadwallader. "Why didn't he use his interest to get Ladislaw made an attaché or sent to India? That is how families get rid of troublesome sprigs."
"There is no knowing to what lengths the mischief may go," said Sir James anxiously. "But if Casaubon says nothing, what can I do?"
"Oh, my dear Sir James," said the rector, "don't let us make too much of all this. It is likely enough to end in mere smoke. After a month or two, Brooke and this Master Ladislaw will get tired of each other. Ladislaw will take wing, Brooke will sell the Pioneer, and everything will settle down again as usual."
"There is one good chance, that he will not like to feel his money oozing away," said Mrs. Cadwallader. "If I knew the items of election expenses, I could scare him. It's no use plying him with wide words like expenditure. I wouldn't talk of phlebotomy. I would empty a pot of leeches upon him."
"What we good, stingy people don't like is having our sixpences sucked away from us."
"And he will not like having things raked up against him," said Sir James. "There is the management of his estate. They have begun upon that already. And it really is painful for me to see. It is a nuisance under one's very nose. I do think one is bound to do the best for one's land and tenants, especially in these hard times.
Perhaps the trumpet may rouse him to make a change, and some good may come of it all, said the rector. I know I should be glad. I should hear less grumbling when my tithe is paid. I don't know what I should do if there were not a modus in Tipton.
I want him to have a proper man to look after things. I want him to take on Garth again, said Sir James. He got rid of Garth 12 years ago, and everything has been going wrong since. I think of getting Garth to manage for me. He has made such a capital plan for my buildings, and Lovegood is hardly up to the mark. But Garth would not undertake the Tipton estate again unless Brooke left it entirely to him.
In the right of it, too, said the rector. Garth is an independent fellow, an original, simple-minded fellow. One day, when he was doing some valuation for me, he told me point-blank that clergymen seldom understood anything about business and did mischief when they meddled. But he said it as quietly and respectfully as if he'd been talking to me about sailors. He would make a different parish of Tipton if Brooke would let him manage. I wish by the help of the trumpet you could bring that round.
If Dorothea had kept near her uncle, there would have been some chance, said Sir James. She might have got some power over him in time, and she was always uneasy about the estate. She had wonderfully good notions about such things. But now Casaubon takes her up entirely. Celia complains a good deal. We can hardly get her to dine with us since he had that fit.
Sir James ended with a look of pitying disgust, and Mrs. Cadwallader shrugged her shoulders, as much as to say that she was not likely to see anything new in that direction.
"Poor Casaubon," the rector said. "That was a nasty attack. I thought he looked shattered the other day at the archdeacon's."
"In point of fact," resumed Sir James, not choosing to dwell on fits, "Brooke doesn't mean badly by his tenants or anyone else, but he has got that way of paring and clipping at expenses."
"Come, that's a blessing," said Mrs. Cadwallader. "That helps him to find himself in the morning. He may not know his own opinions, but he does know his own pocket."
"I don't believe a man is in pocket by stinginess on his land," said Sir James.
"Oh, stinginess may be abused like other virtues. It will not do to keep one's own pigs lean," said Mrs. Cadwallader, who had risen to look out of the window. "But talk of an independent politician, and he will appear."
"What, Brooke?" said her husband.
"Yes. Now, you apply him with the trumpet, Humphrey, and I will put the leeches on him. What will you do, Sir James?"
"The fact is, I don't like to begin about it with Brooke, in our mutual position. The whole thing is so unpleasant. I do wish people would behave like gentlemen," said the good baronet, feeling that this was a simple and comprehensive programme for social well-being.
"Here you all are, eh?"
said Mr. Brooke, shuffling round and shaking hands.
"I was going up to the hall by and by, Chetham, but it's pleasant to find everybody, you know. Well, what do you think of things? Going on a little fast. It was true enough what Lafitte said. Since yesterday, a century has passed away. They're in the next century, you know, on the other side of the water, going on faster than we are."
"Why, yes," said the rector, taking up the newspaper. "Here is the trumpet accusing you of lagging behind. Did you see?"
"Eh? No," said Mr. Brooke,
dropping his gloves into his hat and hastily adjusting his eyeglass. But Mr. Cadwallader kept the paper in his hand, saying with a smile in his eyes,
"Look here. All this is about a landlord not 100 miles from Middlemarch who receives his own rents. They say he is the most retrogressive man in the county. I think you must have taught them that word in the Pioneer."
"Oh, that is Keck, an illiterate fellow, you know. Retrogressive now, come, that's capital. He thinks it means destructive." "They want to make me out a destructive, you know," said Mr. Brooke,
with that cheerfulness which is usually sustained by an adversary's ignorance.
"I think he knows the meaning of the word. Here is a sharp stroke or two. If we had to describe a man who is retrogressive in the most evil sense of the word, we should say he is one who would dub himself a reformer of our constitution, while every interest for which he is immediately responsible is going to decay. A philanthropist who cannot bear one rogue to be hanged but does not mind five honest tenants being half-starved. A man who shrieks at corruption and keeps his farms at rack rent, who roars himself red at rotten boroughs and does not mind if every field on his farms has a rotten gate. A man very open-hearted to Leeds and Manchester, no doubt. He would give any number of representatives who will pay for their seats out of their own pockets. What he objects to giving is a little return on rent days to help a tenant to buy stock, or an outlay on repairs to keep the weather out at a tenant's barn door, or make his house look a little less like an Irish cottier's. But we all know the wag's definition of a philanthropist, a man whose charity increases directly as the square of the distance. And so on. All the rest is to show what sort of legislator a philanthropist is likely to make, ended the rector, throwing down the paper and clasping his hands at the back of his head, while he looked at Mr. Brooke with an air of amused neutrality. "Come, that's rather good, you know," said Mr. Brooke, taking up the paper and trying to bear the attack as easily as his neighbour did, but colouring and smiling rather nervously. "That about roaring himself red at rotten boroughs. I never made a speech about rotten boroughs in my life. And as to roaring myself red and that kind of thing, these men never understand what is good satire. Satire, you know, should be true up to a certain point. I recollect they said that in the Edinburgh somewhere. It must be true up to a certain point." "Well, that is really a hit about the gates," said Sir James, anxious to tread carefully. "Dagley complained to me the other day that he hadn't got a decent gate on his farm. Garth has invented a new pattern of gate. I wish you would try it. One ought to use some of one's timber in that way." "You go in for fancy farming, you know, Chetham," said Mr. Brooke, appearing to glance over the columns of the Trumpet. "That's your hobby, and you don't mind the expense." "I thought the most expensive hobby in the world was standing for Parliament," said Mrs. Cadwallader. "They said the last unsuccessful candidate at Middlemarch, Giles, wasn't his name, spent £10,000 and failed because he did not bribe enough. What a bitter reflection for a man!" "Somebody was saying," said the rector laughingly, "that East Retford was nothing to Middlemarch for bribery."
"Nothing of the kind," said Mr. Brooke. "The Tories bribe, you know. Hawley and his set bribe with treating, hot coddlings and that sort of thing, and they bring the voters drunk to the poll. But they are not going to have it their own way in future, not in future, you know. Middlemarch is a little backward, I admit. The free men are a little backward, but we shall educate them. We shall bring them on, you know. The best people there are on our side."
"Hawley says you have men on your side who will do you harm," remarked Sir James. "He says Bulstrode the banker will do you harm."
"And that if you got pelted," interposed Mrs. Cadwallader, "half the rotten eggs would mean hatred of your committee man. Good heavens, think what it must be to be pelted for wrong opinions. And I seem to remember a story of a man they pretended to chair and let him fall into a dust heap on purpose."
"Pelting is nothing to their finding holes in one's coat," said the rector. "I confess that's what I should be afraid of, if we parsons had to stand at the hustings for preferment. I should be afraid of their reckoning up all my fishing days. Upon my word, I think the truth is the hardest missile one can be pelted with."
"Fact is," said Sir James, "if a man goes into public life, he must be prepared for the consequences. He must make himself proof against calumny."
"My dear Chetham, that is all very fine, you know," said Mr. Brooke. "But how will you make yourself proof against calumny? You should read history. Look at ostracism, persecution, martyrdom, and that kind of thing. They always happen to the best men, you know. But what is that in Horace? Fiat justitia ruat something or other."
"Exactly," said Sir James, with a little more heat than usual. "What I mean by being proof against calumny is being able to point to the fact as a contradiction."
"And it is not martyrdom to pay bills that one has run into oneself," said Mrs. Cadwallader.
But it was Sir James's evident annoyance that most stirred Mr. Brooke.
"Well, you know, Chetham," he said, rising, taking up his hat and leaning on his stick, "you and I have a different system.
You are all for outlay with your farms. I don't want to make out that my system is good under all circumstances. Under all circumstances, you know.
There ought to be a new valuation made from time to time, said Sir James. Returns are very well occasionally, but I like a fair valuation. What do you say, Cadwallader?
I agree with you. If I were Brooke, I would choke the trumpet at once by getting Garth to make a new valuation of the farms and giving him carte blanche about gates and repairs.
That's my view of the political situation, said the rector,
broadening himself by sticking his thumbs in his armholes and laughing towards Mr. Brooke.
That's a showy sort of thing to do, you know, said Mr. Brooke. But I should like you to tell me of another landlord who has distressed his tenants for arrears as little as I have. I let the old tenants stay on. I'm uncommonly easy, let me tell you, uncommonly easy. I have my own ideas and I take my stand on them, you know. A man who does that is always charged with eccentricity, inconsistency and that kind of thing. When I change my line of action, I shall follow my own ideas.
After that, Mr. Brooke remembered that there was a packet which he had omitted to send off from the Grange, and he bade everybody hurriedly good-bye.
"I didn't want to take a liberty with Brooke," said Sir James. "I see he is nettled. But as to what he says about old tenants, in point of fact, no new tenant would take the farms on the present terms."
"I have a notion that he will be brought round in time," said the rector. "But you were pulling one way, Eleanor, and we were pulling another. You wanted to frighten him away from expense, and we want to frighten him into it. Better let him try to be popular and see that his character as a landlord stands in his way."
"I don't think it signifies two straws about the Pioneer, or Ladislaw, or Brooks speechifying to the Middlemarchers, but it does signify about the parishioners in Tipton being comfortable."
"Excuse me, it is you two who are on the wrong tack," said Mrs. Cadwallader. "You should have proved to him that he loses money by bad management, and then we should all have pulled together. If you put him a horseback on politics, I warn you of the consequences. It was all very well to ride on sticks at home and call them ideas."
End of Disc 12.